Good afternoon. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, April 7th, 2009. Welcome. I am going to take the bill slightly out of order and begin first by opening a work session on Senate Bill 772 and ask Lori to just give us a brief summary of where we are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you remember, this is a landlord-tenant coalition bill from the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. We have a couple of bills from landlord-tenant coalitions, and you had a public hearing on this on March 26th, I believe. At that time, we had some dash one amendments, but on that same day, we received dash twos, and one of the proponents walked us through the dash twos. They clarify some of the terms. You do have a copy, again, of the dash twos in front of you. They clarify some of the terms in the measure and amounts of potential recoveries by the tenant from the landlord if the landlord does not comply with some of the billing method conversion provisions. You remember that were part of the bill is introduced. There are a number of other technical amendments that were talked about on the 26th of March. And there is a no revenue impact. There has been a fiscal statement issued just today, but it's being clarified.
And so it's my intent to adopt the dash two amendments today, and then we have re-notified this for Thursday so we can get some questions answered about the fiscal analysis.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 772, dated 3-26-09.
Senator George moves to adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 772. Any discussion? Any objection? The dash two amendments to Senate Bill 772 are the dash two amendments are adopted, and I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 772, and we will see this again on Thursday. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 811 and ask Lori to please give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 811 revises some provisions relating to liens for homeowners association assessments in planned communities and condominiums. It makes some technical changes in statutory language. It specifies the ways the association board may enforce a lien. It prioritizes certain association assessments before a first mortgage or trust deed when foreclosing on the lien. It specifies some of the criteria for that prioritization of the association assessments. There is a dash one amendment that we just received today, and that clarifies some of the assessments subject to the priority lien of the association. It revises specific actions required of the association when foreclosing on lien, and it specifies contents of a notice to lender when the owner of a lot is in default and a lien for unpaid assessments may be attached to property. You do have a copy of those dash ones before you.
Thank you, and I do want to reiterate that we just received the dash ones today. And we will start with a panel of Denise, Rich, and Karna. Please, come on up. Welcome, and I'll leave it up to you to decide who's going to go first.
Madam Chair, Rich Vial. I'm an attorney with Vial Fotheringham, one of the members of a group that has worked for the last 26 years on homeowner association legislation here before the Oregon legislature. To my left is Denise Bauer, a property manager who has also worked for almost that long. She doesn't look that old, but she's worked a very long time in the field. And to my right is Karna Gafteson, also a lawyer engaged in similar activities as our firm. Quickly, I'm going to give you a two-minute overview just so that we have an understanding of why these homeowner association bills continue to arrive before you. The history of homeowner associations goes back to condominiums in the early 70s. That was a very specific type of ownership that provided for horizontal boundaries where you were selling airspace. By the early 80s, people began to also create common interests in properties that weren't just horizontal boundaries. So you could have a townhouse-style architecture, for example, that was submitted to a declaration. A homeowners association was necessary to manage and administer the affairs of the association. These homeowners associations are mini municipalities in virtually every respect. They are maintaining people's property. They are enforcing their rules. In a lot of places, they're providing their water. They're collecting their garbage. There are so many functions that often in history were done by a municipality, now done by a homeowner association, that the assessments that are the subject of 811 are critical to the lifeblood of an association. Today, the frequency of foreclosures has left many homeowners associations without adequate funds to fully take care of and provide those services that the homeowners association requires. And we're not talking about wants, we're talking about critical needs. So this bill, very simply, in the macro sense, provides 6 months of a homeowner assessment priority for the homeowners association. With that overview, I'm going to turn it over to Karna and then Denise to fill in some more of the details for you.
Thank you. And we'll hear from each of you and then do questions when you've all had an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To testify. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Karna Gustafson. I am an attorney that represents about approximately 1,200 homeowners associations / condominium associations, and I'm primarily in charge of collecting the assessments. As you can imagine, with the current state of the economy, our department has grown tenfold, and a lot of associations are facing they're struggling with paying their bills, such as Rich mentioned, water and sewer, insurance for the buildings, garbage expenses, and things like that. The bill in front of you actually requires a foreclosing lender to pay 6 months' worth of assessments upon the foreclosure. So when the bank foreclosing lender goes to sell the property, they pay 6 months' worth of back dues that the owner failed to pay. Now, why is this important? Because the association, at this point, the lender, from the beginning of foreclosure to the end of foreclosure, which does typically take 6 months, the owner hasn't been paying. The lender locks them out of their home, turns off various different utilities, winterizes, or shuts down the property, and the owner has walked away. This then creates a little bit of a vacuum in that the owner isn't paying. The budget then has to be reallocated amongst all the other homeowners, which once they were paying $100 a month, now they're paying $200 a month. It actually causes a spiral effect in that that owner then can't pay their mortgage or the dues, and they go into foreclosure themselves. So we're finding actually projects that are nearly bankrupt and having struggling actually to make the required payments, like such as insurance and water and sewer and garbage and things like that. So I'll also we have a copy of the email that I sent out as well as some articles that was sent to you over the weekend. We've provided 25 copies of that. I also have an email that was sent to you this morning at 8 o'clock from a bank that represents associations, Community Association Bank. They provide loans to associations to make repairs when the association doesn't have enough money. If the delinquencies exceed 7%, for a lot of these banks, the banks won't lend the association money. So there goes another avenue for them to actually get money to actually make these repairs. They are no longer, because of the delinquencies, able to borrow money from a bank to actually make the repairs to the buildings or pay other necessary expenses. So I do have 25 copies of this bank's email, also in support of Senate Bill 811. Denise?
Thank you. I'm Vice President of a community management company, CMI.
I'm sorry, could you start with your name, please?
Heath Bauer. And I'm Vice President of a community management company known as CMI, Community Management Incorporated. We manage about 140 different communities, about 1,300 units. I'm also here representing CAI LAC. CAI stands for Community Association Institute. It's a national organization. We have about 29,000 members. That's correct. And I also am a member of ALCAM, Oregon Washington Community Association Managers, which is also supporting this bill as well. And I'm mostly here, I think they've already said most of what needs to be said that you need to know, but I'm here for questions from the community manager point of view.
Terrific. Thank you. Questions, committee?
Senator George?
I visited earlier with some of you in my office, so didn't ask this question, but it came to mind as I was thinking about it. Is the fee that I would pay as a person who lives in a homeowner association, is that attached to me personally or attached only to the home? Meaning, is the owner of the property responsible for it, or is it attached to the property?
Chair Bonamici, Senator George, it's both. There is a personal obligation the moment you take title to a unit or lot for any assessments that are required under the declaration, and it constitutes a lien on the property as well. The Homeowners Association has the choice of which remedy to pursue, but the problem that I think Karna pointed out very clearly is, even though that personal remedy is available, if we've got somebody who's been through a foreclosure and has disappeared, the Homeowners Association 99% of the time is not going to be able to recover on the personal remedy, in spite of the fact that the lien is gone under current law through the foreclosure.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Sure.
In these situations where people default, what percentage of the times do you actually pursue the homeowner who has disappeared through some kind of a collections agency versus how often do you just attach it to the lien?
Well, Karna mentioned that they have about 1,200 homeowner associations. Our firm represents about 2,000. So between us, we're talking 3,200. Let's see if we're consistent, Karna. we do both. Okay. We typically pursue the personal obligation first. And if unable to collect under the personal obligation, we may pursue the lien and foreclosure route, but we pursue the individual first. Unfortunately, in these foreclosure environments, that is rarely successful.
I echo Rich's comments. We try very hard to, the association just needs the money. They don't want to own the property. They don't want to foreclose. The 6 months priority for the association assessments is not something where the association can foreclose for. It's just as the bank forecloses its lien, it's an obligation then of the bank when it sells to pay this back 6 months. There's at least 10, maybe more other states that already have the 6 month requirement. Nevada right now is considering changing the 6 months to 24 months because of the importance of this. It is a Fannie Mae approved requirement. It is found in the Fannie Mae regs. So on the secondary mortgage market, this is an accepted practice of the 6 months priority being part of the statute.
And Chair Bonamici, if I might add, the real consequences of not having this is that the rest of the owners obviously got to pay more. Now, that may not seem like much if you're in the city of Portland and a few people default on their property taxes, everybody else picks it up. But in a 25-unit condominium complex, that can be devastating to those who have to pick up that owner's failure to pay. And the other consequence is often, instead of having enough to pay the regular bills, they'll start tapping those reserves that the legislature required we all collect as homeowners associations so that we don't have to hit people with huge assessments when we replace the roof or whatever. Pretty soon those reserves are gone, just staying alive when we don't have these regular assessments collected. So they are pretty severe consequences, and that's why we're urging support of the bill.
I wanted to ask a question. If you could give an example of what would happen, because currently there's a lien. This has just changed the priority, is my understanding. What would happen under existing law versus under the provisions of Senate Bill 811? Because under existing law, you would be able to collect, but it's a timing issue. Is that correct?
Yeah. The under existing law, if we can get it from the individual, we'll collect it. But if we can't, and Citicorp is a good example, because the unfortunate truth is that some lenders, especially back in the last time we had this experience, the early 80s, would not foreclose for a year or two. They just wouldn't take the property back. Now we had no one paying. The lender doesn't own it, so they don't have to pay as long as they haven't taken title. And that's why you saw in the existing law this idea that we can force the lender to foreclose. But it still takes 6 months. So during that six-month period, we're not getting anything. Under this provision, under these changes, we would be able to get the assessments that were accruing, in essence, during the time that the foreclosure was taking place. And so we're picking up an extra 6 months' worth of assessment. Now, if the foreclosure takes a year or 18 months, for whatever reason, we've only got 6 months' worth of extra assessments. But it does give us those extra assessments.
And I would like to point out, Senator Bonamici and members of the committee, that this does not include fines. This is just the operating expenses of the association, and that exclusion was put into the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. Other questions? I wonder if you wanted, if one of you would please sort of explain to us the difference between the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments, because we just received that, so it would be helpful to kind of get a summary of what's in the Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah, it's as simple as Karna just described it. The term assessment under current law includes not just your operating expenses, but it also includes fines for enforcement, just like we have in municipal law, the ability to collect fines through typical lien processes. We have that. We can collect it through the lien process, but we are excluding that from this six-month period, the idea being it's not fair for the bank to have to suffer the failure of the owner to have complied with parking regulations or paint their house or whatever led to that fine. So that's it's that simple. It's the exclusion of those fines.
There was one additional amendment, though, it is fairly simple, but the Oregon Condominium Act currently has a provision, as Rich pointed out, that lets the association kind of force banks to foreclose. That conforming language has also now been put into the Planned Community Act. It's currently in the Condominium Act. Legislative Council made those uniform at our request. Not at our request. He actually thought that it was a good idea to actually have both acts similar, since they're both actually community associations. They both act the same, so they both should have the same provision in them.
That goes to my earlier testimony about the fact that we had a condo law first and then we got a Planned Community Act. They should have run consistent all along with respect to how a homeowner association operates, but over the years there's been some things that got out of sync, and this is one that Legislative Council caught, and we fully agree that should be in sync. So that is the other minor amendment.
In the Dash 1?
Yes.
Thank you. Questions?
Sure. Thank you. Is there a minimum threshold of units at which these laws apply?
There is not a, Senator Rosenbaum, there is not a minimum amount. However, there is permits an exception for 7 units or less if the bank and the, when they first create the declaration, the bank is allowed to foreclose out the declaration and actually foreclose out the project. So for 7 units or less, this does not apply. In situations where they've agreed to a subordination. I know that's kind of confusing. Rich, you might be able to help
well,
me there.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, I think that Carney did a really good job of explaining what is an amazingly complex principle, but it is true that, in essence, if the lender chooses, they can avoid the bad consequences of this for these small projects. But it's a complex way that they have to go through to get there. And otherwise, 2 units, it probably is more profoundly important to have 2 units have this protection than it is 200 units, because if you're half and you got to now pay everything, it's really a burden on you.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Next, Tim Martinez. And Pam, are you coming up with Tim?
No. Can we go first?
I'll come with you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association in opposition to Senate Bill 811. I guess I should first point out that the bank they made reference to is not an Oregon bank and is not a member of the Oregon Bankers Association, so we're not divided within our own association. I do thank the proponents of the bill. They did come to the United Financial Lobby last fall. United Financial Lobby is the bankers, the credit unions, mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, consumer finance companies, and presented their proposal, and we listened very carefully to it and told them that we'd get back to them shortly thereafter, which we did, and we told them we were going to oppose this legislation if they went forward. We also appreciate that they did put it in a separate bill rather than putting it in their broad bill, which has happened from time to time. But so we do thank them for both of those things. I think the first thing I would like to say is that there seems to be a misunderstanding between a condo association and a homeowners association. They really are two different items. They're in two different sections of the statute. Homeowners association are in ORS 94, and the condo is ORS 100, I believe, if I could find that. Yeah. But I believe that's correct. So the main difference is, excuse me for the committee's help, is when you buy a condo, you own the inside walls. You don't own the basic structure. You don't own the land. You just basically are buying the inside walls. In a homeowners association, you generally own not only the home, whether it's stick or manufactured, as well as the land underneath it. And the Homeowners Association can be a one-stop shop where they do include everything from garbage to cable to the whole nine yards. Or it can simply be a Homeowners Association put in place for architectural standards to make sure that, you know, you don't have somebody with a purple house. Not there's anything wrong with purple, but so you wouldn't have a purple house. So there really is a difference between those two statutes. And they do have currently in statute a priority lien on the condo side. And as we see this bill, I don't know that we'd agree it's a simple change, but it looks like they're trying to match the homeowners association statute with the condo side. We strongly feel that every time you pass a bill and a lien that puts somebody or some group above the first mortgage, you make it more difficult for those first mortgages to be made. You put another red flag up to lenders of all types on where they want to get involved with that particular piece of property, because they know down the road that they potentially would lose part of their interest because of where they would fall in line. So having said that, we do have some problems. I made the mistake of asking your administrator if there were any amendments at about 11:30, and she said there were, so I have not had a lot of time to look at them. I think Pam may tell you that as well. But my quick glance is they do not improve them from our perspective.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. My notes on the original Senate Bill 811, our attorney didn't feel like they were going to take the prior first mortgage lien or the lien of the association over the first mortgage. And so I came here just to listen to the bill, just for my own information, and saw the Dash 1 amendments just as I walked in the door. And so we obviously have some concerns. And as with Tim, you know, anytime you do put the lien of something else prior to the first mortgage, we certainly have concerns about that. So I'd like to have the opportunity to take those back to my membership and have some discussions with them on the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Questions?
Thank you. For Mr. Martinez, you said that with condos, the lien is ahead of the first mortgage?
It is.
And how does that work, and how would that...
Well, it's very similar to what they propose. In fact, if you look at their Dash 1 amendments, the underlying law starts on page 8, I believe, paragraph 7. It walks you all through... And no, excuse me, 8 is it. And it walks you all through what they do, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, the steps that they have to take. And it is, as they described it in their testimony, that they do let us know and let us know that they could be ahead of us. But again, we just see a real difference between a condo, because I think some of the articles even that they talked about, when you have a big condo development, there can be situations where lenders do not immediately put the property back on the market. But typically, when you're talking a home, a single-family home, then that's generally not the case. They want to turn that around as quickly as they can. So there's no incentive, I guess, for them to hang on to that property.
Questions? Any Bridge, do you have another question?
No.
I wanted to ask, Tim, is there a I'm looking for some sort of time frame, because it seems like it's in the best interest of the financial institution that the property be maintained. So is there some sort of time frame that maybe 2 or 3 months instead of 6 months that your members might be comfortable with to get at least get some of the work done that needs to be done?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'd certainly agree with you that it is important for the property to be maintained, whether it's a condo, whether it's in the homeowners association, or whether it's just a single-family home. I mean, we need to maintain it to hold the value. In this particular case, though, the underlying agreement that the homeowners sign when they become part of this association is that from time to time they have to may pay additional fees and assessments in order to keep that property up. So, again, there is law in place that requires them to do that. We certainly don't want to hold on to property any longer than we have to. It's a little tough to sell some of them these days, but we, you know, we're not in the business of selling properties. We're in the business of making loans on properties.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay, is there anyone else here to testify about Senate Bill 811? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 811 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 963. Lori, can you please give us a brief summary?
Madam Chair, I get to summarize a 43-page bill. Yeah, actually, it's not all new language, as you see. Senate Bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 963 revises certain provisions governing homeowners associations and planned communities and condominiums. It adds some provisions specifying eligibility, qualifications, and criteria for service as a member of the planned community board of directors. It adds that same kind of provision for service as a member of a condominium board of directors. It adds some provisions, pertaining to dissolution of homeowners association and governance by an unincorporated association and planned community. Clarifies some application of zoning, building code, or similar laws, ordinances, or regulations in condominium form of ownership. Gives authorized persons the right of entry to perform necessary maintenance, repair, or replacement if the association is responsible for the property. Proponents and opponents of the previous bill indicated, you know, the variances and similarities, both that happened in Chapter 94, which focuses on the Planned Community Act, and Chapter 100 that focuses on the Condominium Act. So one thing, just as a last note to those of you who have gone through the bill, there are some provisions that you'll read and then you'll say, wait a minute, I already read that. And one of the reasons is because some of the provisions are mirrored, applied to Chapter 94, and then are replicated with just the provisions of, you know, referencing condominiums in Chapter 100. And the last thing I will leave you with is that there are significant amendments that will probably be spoken to, but we have not seen because we have not received them from Legislative Council.
Thank you, and thank you, Lori, for the summary. And I'm certain that all the committee members did pick up on that distinction as they were reading through the bill.
Absolutely.
So there are five people here, and I think I'd like to start with Denise and Richard, and then did you want Karna to come up with you or Howard? Because there's three chairs.
Maybe we could scoot another chair up if that would be
sure.
All right.
That would be fine.
Make that happen.
They can just pull another chair up. That's fine.
No, we can't. They're all connected.
No, we can unclip them though.
Okay.
No, we'll help you do that. Not a problem. Excuse me.
No, I got it.
You want this one? How about this one? Got it?
Welcome, and if you want to go ahead, Richard, if you're going to start again. And
I'm just going to introduce it, if I could, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that I follow up on something that Ms. Brocker said that's very important, without criticizing Mr. Martinez's testimony, it corrects something that's critical here, and that is that homeowner associations
and condominiums can't really be distinguished as was described. There is an ownership level of distinction, the way something gets platted or the way it gets surveyed. But for example, a large townhouse project that is platted as a planned community, that the association in the declaration is responsible for maintenance of the roofs, the siding, the landscaping, the roads and streets, basically everything except the interior of the unit, operates exactly like a condominium in a high-rise. It just happens to be on a, not stacked and side by side. But for all intents and purposes, there is no difference in the way that they operate, and that's critical to understanding many of the things that are in front of you, because what they have done, and again with the help of legislative counsel, what we've done is try to conform a homeowners association that has all the same functions regardless of how the survey was drawn as a condominium project, and have those work the same way. And it is a very important thing to us that the legislature appreciate that we are trying the best we can to meet the expectations of owners who, they don't know how it was surveyed. All they know is that they're in a homeowners association, they got to pay a fee, the HOA is supposed to maintain my roof and siding. Whether it's a condo or a planned community doesn't make a whit of difference to them. And we're trying to make it so that the law doesn't surprise them in their expectations. There's one other general principle that I want to introduce to the committee, if I might, and that is this. I am sensitive, we are all sensitive to the fact that this is a huge bill. And this isn't the first session we've come to the legislature with these big bills with a whole bunch of little things in them. What happens is this. Every 2 years is our only chance to fix stuff. And the homeowners association market has grown so fast since all of us began dealing with this. I know Howard was involved in the 70s, and Karn and I became involved in the 80s, and Denise was around in the 80s. And since that time, all of our businesses have grown just by leaps and bounds, and the last couple years was one of the fastest growth periods that we've experienced. Now it's slowing down, of course, with the economy, but as it grows, new problems come to our attention. Someone finds that, gee, I was incorporated, but somebody forgot to maintain the corporation, and now that I'm unincorporated, I've got a bunch of problems. And so we address that in the bill. Or we want to provide an easement to a city or a county that wants to put a sewer line through our property, but we can't do it without having all the owners vote on it. And we can't get all the owners actively to think about it and participate in it. Those little things, and I want the committee to know that it's not that we're trying to solve one homeowner association's problem. What we see is, oops, that's something that really is potentially a problem for more than just the people that have brought it to us in this circumstance. Let's try and solve it. And so most of what you see, I would say virtually all of what you see, is that kind of amendment, an attempt to do this. We are, Howard exclusively represents developer, well, occasionally represents a non-developer association, but almost exclusively represents developers. I exclusively represent homeowners association. Karna does both. Denise manages projects both pre-turnover and post-turnover. This really is sort of an ecumenical group that has brought together the interests of all of the parties in the homeowner association environment. And other than that lien provision, and we did separate out 811 for the purpose that Mr. Martinez said, these are things that affect us all, both in the process of development and as the homeowner association continues to operate. Now, I'm tired. I could go through them one by one. I'm kind of inclined not to. I'd maybe like to invite those who are here with me to mention one or two of the ones that they have worked on, and then
give the committee the opportunity to ask some questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And just to, I would like to wait for specific questions, but a general question in light of what you just explained. Are these all in 963 problems that have come up in the last couple of years since the last change, or are they sort of modifications of changes that didn't go exactly as you expected? I'm just curious about that.
Go ahead.
Keep it in mind as we're considering.
Senator Bonamici and members of the committee, we work every year continuously throughout the year on these things. Our last bill had a lot of fixes and clarifications, but we can't, as all of us are volunteers, we can't get to them all. So, no, I would have to say that they aren't stuff that's just come up in the last 2 years. They're stuff that come over time, and we just don't have the time to get to all of them. Plus, our bill last session was so long, we already got in trouble for having our bill so long last time that we said, well, let's just wait till next session.
I'm not sure I want to know how long
to actually get to some of these other things. And then there was a few things that we overlooked that we just didn't know about.
I should say that it is true. If we were to wait and cover everything in one bill, you'd probably see a 1,000-page bill. These things have problems, and they're complex. It's like a municipality, and there are just a lot of things that come up. So thank you.
And as you start, if you want to please start by stating your name for the record, and then whoever wants to go next, please.
My name is Howard Purstein. I'm an attorney with Stowe Reeves, LLP. I support the entire bill, but I just wanted to address one particular section of the bill that I'm particularly interested in because of my interest in green building and renewable energy. And that has to do with Section 14, which relates to renewable energy contracts. Of course, the current economy has pretty much slowed down any new development at all. But we know that there are projects in the state scheduled to be developed whenever the economy permits, which will involve green building and renewable energy. And these are projects which will have solar panels on them. I even know of some projects on drawing boards will have wind turbines, anything you can imagine in the renewable energy field. There are people who are interested in developing these types of projects. And the only way they can be developed is using some of the laws that encourage that type of development, which include tax credits for investors to put up renewable energy facilities. And the way those statutes work is that the investor owns the facilities, then makes them available to the project, is paid back for the investment of these facilities over a period of time. But the investor, of course, won't do that unless they can amortize the cost of their investment in these solar panels or wind turbines over a period of time and get paid back for them. The current statute basically prohibits contracts that are entered into at the outset of a development unless they are 3 years or less, and they are all subject to termination by the association at the time of turnover. Well, no investor will invest in these facilities if they find out in 3 years or a year the contract will be rejected and they'll have to pull the facilities out and never get paid for them. So the purpose of this provision is to exempt from that limitation renewable energy type contracts and contracts for renewable energy facilities as long as those contracts are recorded and of record. Now the owners will all be aware of them. Their budgets that they all receive will have built into them the cost of paying back for these facilities, so it will all be known and disclosed to them. And I think it's important for green energy and green development in the state that we permit this type of development.
Karna Gustafson, partner with Landy Bennett Blumstein, representing homeowners associations and condominium associations. I'm going to talk briefly about Section 3, which has a parallel of Section 24. And this is when an association has its incorporation status lapse. Several years ago, the condominium associations were not required to be incorporated. The legislature changed the statute to require condominium associations to be incorporated as long as because they were four or more units. The Planned Community Act has always required the association to be incorporated. But as we know, these are volunteer boards of directors, the board chairs change, the registered agent changes, and the notice goes to somebody that doesn't live there anymore. So occasionally the incorporation status lapses and they need to be reinstated. This basically provides that it doesn't become a new entity. It's the same entity, same board of directors, same bylaws, same same obligations, rules, and regulations, and it doesn't become some different entity that has to elect a new board and has new bylaws. And that's what this provision provides, somewhat paternalistic, I guess, to make sure that they are protected in case something like this happens.
Denise, do you have one that you'd like to use as an example? I'll just add one more for the committee. I may not have introduced myself during this hearing, so let me say I'm Rich Vile with Vile Fotheringham, and our firm represents condominium and homeowner associations. A good example of the kind of change or the kind of amendment that we have in this bill is found in Section 9, and we actually have a tweak because legislative council didn't quite get it correct the first time, but the change here is to basically allow quorum to be established in person or by proxy and lower the quorum threshold so that work can actually get done when things are going well. Homeowner associations tend not to have a lot of their owners show up to a meeting. And I guess that's a good thing, but where you have high quorum requirements, that means you often can't get your board elected or you can't get your work done. This allows you to reduce these quorums and get your work done.
With notice.
With certain notice, of course. But the point is that this is illustrative of many of the kinds of changes that are found in the bill that would help homeowner associations operate more efficiently, whether in the pre-turnover or post-turnover stage. We did provide to every member of the committee a packet. We have extra copies of the materials that were in the packet in case someone would like additional copies of that. I do want to emphasize that we made every attempt to touch any of the folks that would be interested in these issues. We worked on them for nearly 2 years. We think we've resolved disagreements. We had very, very good cooperative support from the real estate agency. Lori Skillman, who's here, and I think will testify in a moment, has been active in both attending our meetings and monitoring the things that we've done. I know that just in the last few days, she and Howard and Karna have worked out some tweaks to some language that Legislative Council came up with, and I think that we can represent in good faith that this is not a bill that's going to cause any heartburn for any of you because goring someone's ox. We really made every effort to make this a consensus bill. We're all happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Committee? Any questions? Senator George.
It's interesting that you brought up Section 14 because it was actually the section that I read that kind of gave me heartburn. Let me talk at you a little bit about in homeowners associations, there is a certain fiduciary duty you have as the board of directors to your fellow members in the homeowners association.
Right.
The reason why we have a 3-year limitation on contracts, service contracts, is that if somebody, in essence, breaches that fiduciary duty, in essence, you're not locked into a long-term contract. In a politically charged arena like green energy, where there are surges of popularity and overreaction, the tulip effect. For instance, the state of Oregon, we went out and invested money in a solar panels at the intersection of I-5 and 205 with a return of 45 years on a 15-year facility, which means that we won't ever recover the monies we've put into that facility. But it was very popular, and it made great press releases and those kind of things. And what I worry about in these types of situations is that you have a board of directors that is, in essence, sort of exempt from the fiduciary duties of making sound financial decisions. And so if you'll just walk through with that for me and make me feel comfortable that this ensures that there is responsibility and that you can't sign some long-term contract that has long-term detrimental effects to the association.
Right. Well, for one thing, our statutes, this statute and what's already in the statute, basically are disclosure-type statutes. So when the buyers in this type of project buy in this project, they will know that this project has these renewable energy facilities. They will know that it'll have this contract, and they will know what their financial obligations are. And basically what this does is give the buyer the choice. Do you want to buy into this facility, which will have these solar panels or whatever the renewable energy facilities are, and in most cases, they will actually save money by having them. But whether they save money or not, they will know what their costs are going to be, and they will have these disclosures. So they can decide, do they want to buy in a facility because they want to be in a green building, for example. And so they can make that choice. If they don't want to be in a green building, if they don't want to have this financial exposure of paying for these solar panels or these wind turbines, then they should buy someplace else because they will know and they will have that option. So basically this is designed to give them the option to be in this type of facility or not be in this type of facility. In the absence of this bill, they won't have that option because you won't be able to get into a green facility because nobody will be able to put one in because they can't get the tax credits.
Follow, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I guess what I'm also trying to get at, and I appreciate that explanation, I think that's important, in all of these things, such as solar, for instance, there's a bell curve upon the productivity. And I'm envisioning, and just tell me if I'm totally mistaken here, but I'm envisioning a contract that a homeowner association enters into with a service company that provides solar panels, let's say, for instance, mm-hmm. that would require that company that provided the capital get a certain rate of return. And as the solar panels start to reduce their power generation, which they naturally do at 15 years or so, that then there would be a demand that people had no idea that there was backside risk. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's not just disclosure, but it's also a full financial disclosure of the backside risks. Do you see anything in that?
Well, basically, some thought has been given into that in more the last few years. And we were just getting into the point where we have these guaranteed renewable contracts.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm wondering.
And these type contracts basically provide that if you don't get the energy savings that were projected, basically that comes out of the energy provider's pocket. Basically, that's, in a sense, that's kind of refunded to the owners. This is brand new, cutting edge stuff, these contracts, but they are just coming into use now. And that's their design to deal with that specific issue that you've raised.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I wanted to follow up on Senator George's question and ask, is it typical to record this type of contract now, or is this something new?
Interesting, Madam Chair, that you should ask that question. And, Madam Chair, Senator George, I want to correct something. Howard's 20 times as smart as I am on this stuff, but the condo stuff for developers would probably be disclosed, obviously, would
yes.
be disclosed. But in resales, like I think Senator George was asking, where you're 10 years downstream and the board decides that they want to enter into one of these long-term contracts, that might not necessarily be disclosed.
But the current statute would prevent an association from entering into that long-term contract because that's permitted by law right now.
Correct. So I was going to ask Senator George, if I might, whether it would make this more palatable if we had a mechanism so that these types of contracts were recorded and that recording information had in it some of the kinds of things that you're talking about. Now, I did that one off the cuff and I
didn't know. Senator Bonamici, members of the chair, and Senator George, the statute requires it to be recorded in full, and that was one of the things that we had quite a bit of discussion in our committee about, because some of us represent associations, some represent developers, and some were concerned about Senator George's very issue, and so we required the contract to be recorded in full. I got a call from another law firm last week saying, what do you mean we have to record the entire contract? Our companies may not want to record the entire contract. And I said, well, maybe they shouldn't be doing the work then, because as far as I'm concerned, that contract needs to be recorded. And 20 years from now, that company may be defunct, or it might have sold to somebody else. And who knows what the provisions of the contract were, or what the obligations of the association were. So it was compromised that the entire contract must be recorded and would be revealed in the title report, a preliminary title report of a purchaser when they came to want to buy this unit or lot.
I think that begs the question that Senator George was asking, though, and that is, do we also require more than just the contract to be recorded, and that is certain information disclosed about its likely consequences or potential consequences? It was, did I correctly read that, Senator George?
Chair, the idea of the three-year limitation is to make sure that a board does it, which are volunteers, right? I mean, these people are volunteers. But they don't enter into negotiations with a very sophisticated body and then lock the association into a 10-year contract that really just rips the association off. I mean, that's what the statute, as I understand, is currently meant to protect. And so what we're doing is we're entering in to longer-term contracts under this arena, which is popular right now, but I'm trying to figure out whether or not we actually protect the future owners. And I just want to make sure we're protecting those people from any contract that's bad.
Certainly, Senator George. Going back to the history of the current statute, actually this particular provision was directed at developers, and it really came from what was going on in Florida, where developers were entering into sweetheart recreational contracts with themselves or affiliated entities, saying that, you know, you have to use our recreation facilities, whether you like it or not, forever, and you pay us all this money. And some of that was, none of that was really going on here, but there are other parts of the country. So the particular statute is not directed at the elected board of directors once you've had turnover to the owners, but it was a concern that developers might take advantage of the homeowners by sweetheart deals with themselves.
Gotcha.
And that's a reason for the limitation, and that's a reason for the ability of the board to terminate the contracts after the new board has been elected. But as I indicated, that particular those particular restrictions make it almost impossible to have these renewable energy contracts. And so the compromise is that everybody will know what this contract is. They'll know that they're buying into a green project as renewable energy facilities, and you know, they either buy into that type of project or say, I'm not interested, I don't want to pay extra for it.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And what about the just to follow up on that? What about the current owners? What if the board decides right now we want to enter into one of these contracts? Do they have to get the current owners involved in that decision? Because we're talking about creating the recording so that future purchasers will know about it, but what about current owners?
Currently right now, without this change right now, existing association, which has an elected board of directors, could enter into one of these contracts without a vote of the owners.
But for only for 3 years, is that correct?
And for any period of time. There's no limitation. That's within discretion of the board, right?
I don't think so.
Well, go ahead. You're the association attorney. You answer.
We agree with, Chair Bonamici, we agree with Howard that these provisions were originally written for developers, but over the years we've had the question come to us a number of times, can a management company, for example, get a five-year contract with an existing homeowners association? And we have interpreted the statute to mean that this covers existing homeowners associations as well as developer homeowners associations.
Senator Bonamici, can I respond further?
Please.
In addition, if any of these facilities require an easement and where they have to put a structure on a building or have to put structures on the property, they require to get an easement or a license from the association, which cannot be more than 2 years without a vote of the owners, in which case the vote of the owners would be required if they are actually going to put the facility somewhere where an easement, which in, I would assume, 95% of the case, they are going to have an easement or a license to put this somewhere. So yes, in most cases, you're going to have a vote of the owners.
Thank you.
The exception to that would be municipally sponsored green projects.
another provision of the bill actually allows the board of directors to approve municipal easements over common property. But I think Karna's point is a very important one. It would get the owners involved most of the time.
True.
Thank you. And I had a question about Section 3, and I believe it was Karna who talked about that section. Has this been discussed with the Corporation Division, and are we completely changing corporation law here by saying that the corporation doesn't change if it dissolves and back together?
Senator Bonamici, to answer your question, we have not talked to the Corporation Division, but we do not believe that this is a change from current law in that these associations become unincorporated associations. It is our legal advice that we have been given for umpteen years here, that it did not create a separate association. It just became unincorporated, where they continued with the same bylaws, they continued with the same board of directors. But we've gotten questions lately about, well, what about a roof warranty? If it creates a brand new association, do you have to transfer the warranty from the corporate association to an unincorporated association? Well, as we know, roof warranties, you're not allowed to transfer. And so the warranty becomes void. So we thought we better put it in the statute, an actual statutory provision of what we've always given advice on, that this has been the case because of issues of warranties, to saying that, no, this is the same entity, the warranty follows to the same entity, to make sure that the associations are protected.
If I might add, Senator Bonamici, the original Condominium Act actually said a homeowners association can be unincorporated or incorporated. It doesn't matter. We're going to treat them the same. So all this does is essentially default back to what the legislature originally created, was an unincorporated association that had all the powers. We wanted them to all be incorporated so that we could keep track of them, and we did vet that with the Corporation Division about four sessions ago when we had this incorporation requirement inserted into the statute. What we didn't anticipate is then what happens when one of them lapses, and that's all this does is solve that problem.
Thank you. Any other questions? Really quiet down there, Senator German. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Lori Skillman, and is there anyone else here who, I know Jana was in the room. Anyone else want to come up with Lori? Oh, okay, come on up, Lori.
I can sit with you.
Oh, Karna.
Senator Bonamici and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lori Skillman. I'm a manager with the real estate agency for the state of Oregon. The agency's interest in the bill is that the agency actually regulates the creation of condominiums and amendments to declarations and bylaws and so on. So when a developer creates a condominium, that condominium development must go through the agency for approval before it's created. In terms of the bill as a whole, as everyone has testified, a lot of the provisions of the bill make associations for unit owners for condominiums or homeowners for planned communities a little bit more manageable, a little bit more efficient, and because everything is dictated and governed by statutes, that's why they have to change the statutes to kind of keep up with the times. But it really does provide associations to be a little bit more nimble in the way they operate. The only thing, I'm just going to keep this real brief, the only thing that the agency had some issues about were some real technical issues about language, because that's who I am. It's very important for me that the language is real concise and real clean. And so I spent about 4 hours with two brilliant lawyers from Portland saying, let's work on this language and figure it out, and let's talk about what are some of the purposes of certain provisions. We have put together and have amendments ready to go to Legislative Council. There's nothing that I would say are substantive. It doesn't change the fundamental concept concept of any of the sections of the bill, but it makes them more readable and a little cleaner to implement. So that's all I've got. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Thank you. We very much appreciate that. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wants to testify? And Jana's shaking her head. On Senate Bill 963, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 963, and I don't know how long it will take to get that amendment back. I haven't seen the text of it, so we'll revisit this when we get that back. So that concludes our business for today, and I will close the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. I want to remind